This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl in your podcast feed. And this week, it is NAIDOC week. The theme this year is 50 years of deadly, and it's all about honouring the elders, activists, and communities who have carried the NAIDOC movement forward. And someone who has done that is Corey Tutte. He's a friend of the show. We've had him on before. He's someone who looks at science through a First Nations lens and is all about encouraging the next generation of scientists through his Deadly Science program. We're going to talk about all of that and more in this week's episode, so let's get into it. Right now, we are getting into the world of science, as we always do with Dr. Carl. Dr. Carl, how are you doing?
Ever so peachy keen. Hey, guess what? It's NAIDOC week.
It's NAIDOC week, celebrating all things First Nations excellence. And we've got our mate, friend of the show, Corey Tutte, with us. Corey Tutte of Deadly Science fame. Corey, welcome back.
Yama and happy Black Christmas, everyone.
It's Black Christmas.
It's Black Christmas.
That's it. Thank you so much for being with us. We always love having you on, and you have done a lot since our last visit. In my hot little hand, I have your new book, Before It Was Called Science, Discover 65,000 plus years of First Nations knowledge. Tell us about this book, Corey.
So as you do in your 30s, you either get into smoking meat or World War II rhetoric. I got into Back to the Future. And I was thinking about, like, what was the world before there were tradies? What was the world before there were Bunnings? What was the world before there were influencers? And I started writing about, this was like a follow-up to First Scientist, but how we see knowledge is really important. So you can imagine a young person in a classroom. They see Albert Einstein in a lab coat. They see Thomas Edison. And that is actually a really great, they're great scientists of their time, but that's actually an inhibitor to young people following their passion and purpose. Mm. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to create like a Back to the Future style book that looked at the past that blended into present tense so that young people could see how our mob made clothes based on, you know, environment and necessity. And also wanted to like play on the, you know, when you go to a department store, there is nothing you can't buy in that store. What they sell is there's nothing that won't last more than 10 years. But for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we built tools that were built to be handed down and to last. So it's a real sustainability piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, set up in a way where it's before and after or before and now. And yeah, you speak to different things like before there were shops, you talk about food carriers, water carriers, before there were tradies, how homes were built, canoes, hardware stores. Like you said, before we had Bunnings, you had axes, stone knives, spears. I really want to say to people today, there is so much that you can speak to on this week's episode. What was it like for you also exploring the now and the, you know, young scientists coming through with new research, new discoveries?
I think, you know, there's a lot of negative in the world right now. Mm. But when I think of our young people, I actually get a lot of hope because our young people are incredibly intelligent, incredibly gifted. They need opportunity and resource, and they also need to be heard. And our job as, you know, older people now is to make sure that we use today to make tomorrows better. Mm. And for me, you know, I can get on social media and I can get really down by, you know, politics or what's happening in the world at the moment. But when I see a young person in a classroom, you know, this is your history too. When we talk about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander science, this is your history. We come from the country's first people invented bread. We're the oldest man-made structures on earth. And this is something we should celebrate. And when we celebrate stuff, we have to accept the bad things have happened and learn from them, but we also have a lot to celebrate. And when I see young people in the classroom now, they're picking up First Scientists. You know, we've got young non-Indigenous women and boys picking up books, and they're now seeing the lab coat as just a bit of PPE and not a barrier. And that's really important.
Oh, Corey, I love that. You've been on the show before. You're a real wildlife expert. You also speak a lot about totems and different things through a First Nations science lens. Any kind of questions you want to answer today?
Oh, look, I'm a snake catcher. Since I last came on the show, I went and got my, I have this methodology where I was going to master a skill that I've lost. So I went back. I'm a former zookeeper. Shout out to Shoalhaven Zoo. And I went back and started handling venomous snakes and getting them out of people's houses in my spare time. And that sounds absolutely crazy, but I'm actually really fascinated about the venom and what properties can we use with the venom to make medicines.
Wow.
Things like that. So I'm on a centre of excellence called CREPE, at University of Sydney, and we're investigating peptides and how, you know, animals can help us create the new medications and also answer some of the questions that we have for the future.
Totally. Oh my gosh, so much to explore already. 0439 757 555. I want to hear more about this snake catching a little bit later on, but let's start with Melissa in Eora, Sydney. Melissa, what do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. I was wondering, how different do you think the environment would be here if the thylacine hadn't been wiped out?
Corey.
Yeah, so interesting enough, if the thylacine hadn't have been wiped out, and noting that the thylacine used to be found on the mainland 3,000 years ago, and they were wiped out by dingoes, and we know this because the Yungul Matra painted these animals. So thank you to the mob up there. They proved that these animals lived on the mainland through their paintings and stories, which is awesome. But one of the things is that if the thylacine hadn't have been extinct from Tasmania, Tasmania actually would have been ecologically healthier because thylacines, they would have taken out foxes, cats, and also devil facial tumour. It would have played a huge role in reducing the amounts of Tasmanian devils that had devil facial tumour because weaker animals would get wiped out by the thylacine. What it did is it created an ecological imbalance. And the issue is now, if we were to somehow revive the thylacine, which is, you know, debatable, and put it back, the ecosystem's now changed and adapted to live without it.
Now, Corey, can I ask you, is this what they call the top predator effect?
Yes. So the thylacine was the apex predator of Lutuwia in Tasmania. And when it went extinct, it was replaced by the Tasmanian devil.
Very
but it's so small, that Tasmanian devil.
I know.
It's not about the size of the devil. about its attitude.
Also, the sound it makes. Have you ever heard it? It's crazy. Melissa, does that get you started?
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for kicking us off. We've got Jamie right here. Now, Jamie, what's going on with your nose?
Hey, doctors. How are we?
Good, thank you.
So, ever since I was a kid, or ever since I can remember, I've been able to block my nose completely without touching it, without even thinking about it. So I can, so it shuts off like smell, taste. I can stop water from going up my nose. It's just been something I've always been able to do. And yeah, a couple of years ago, I guess it was, I was talking to a few people and realized that nobody else can do it.
Jamie, I have to ask because I'm just trying to remember. I'm trying to imagine this. When you're blocking your nose, is it maybe a downward motion? Is it an upward scrunch? Is it kind of pulling the nose back into the face? How are you able to do it?
No, like you wouldn't be able to tell I'm doing it by looking at me. I don't physically do anything. It's just literally in the back of my nose, my throat. I don't know how to
explain my gosh.
It, yeah.
Okay, if you're also in this boat, 0439 757 555, but we might have an enigma here with Jamie. Dr. Carl,
yeah,
what's going on?
Jamie, you can do what a small percentage of people can do. And what you're doing is closing internal muscles, which is rare. And they're the muscles of the nasopharynx, which, as you sound, joins the back of your nose to your throat. And this is done by the muscles of the soft palate and also the walls of the throat. And when you do it, you can't smell because there's no chemicals going up there and water can't travel up your nose. Why are you able to do it? Firstly, natural variation. So, for example, there are some people for whom coffee actually stimulates their sleep zone. So to help them sleep, they need coffee. Mm-hmm. So there's massive natural variation in things. And some people can naturally wiggle their ears. So number two, you might have learned that movement very early, accidentally, and kept on going with it. And so my daughter Lola, she was fascinated by the fact that her grandfather could wiggle his ears and then spent an hour, she was very obsessive, and then went ahead and did it. And by the end of that hour, she could wiggle her ears. So you might have had that natural variation, plus or minus, you might have learned the movement very early on. The third thing is one of my favourites, which is proprioception, where you know where your body parts are by knowing all the angles. So you can put your finger on the tip of your nose with your eyes shut because somehow your brain knows the angles of your upper arm, at the elbow, at your hand, your wrist, your fingers. And you actually have some better proprioception of the muscles inside where most of us don't. And it's not just freedivers that do it, because singers and beatboxers and woodwind players, they also do it. But with the freedivers, they're doing it to stop nose coming, water coming up the nose, and also do the equalisation thing. It's not rare. You are special, and we love you very much. Any follow-up questions there, Dr. Jamie?
No, it's just been something that's always been, just always going to be in the back of my head. I just thought it was a normal thing that everyone could do.
Literally always going to be in the back of your head. But this is why I love this show. Jamie, we've already had two people texting in, someone saying, same here, Jamie, another person, I can do this with my nose as well. So you're unique, but you're not alone.
There we go.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So good.
Thanks, guys.
Brent in Berry, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. I'm left-handed. My question is, if all the left-handed people lived in one country and they started breeding over generations, would being left-handed remain the dominant trait?
Ooh, tricky.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the way it goes is that we're left-handed, right-handed to different degrees with different parts of our anatomy. So it goes 90, 80, 70, 60% with being right-handed. Handed, right-footed, right-eared, and right-nosed, and you can pick which eye is dominant by just looking at something far away, and then block one eye, and then the other eye. And if the image does not shift when you block one eye, then the other eye is your dominant eye. So it isn't actually just a single gene. There are hundreds of genes having a tiny effect. About 10% of people on average worldwide are left-handed, but if everybody in the world who was left-handed, then migrated to left-land, we'll call it. Okay, firstly, everybody there would be left-handed almost, and left-handed children would be more common, but it wouldn't be 100%. Right-handed children would still be born. So the word dominant means that, genetics, it means it would be the main characteristic and it would go ahead. And you've got the fascinating case of Tristan da Cunha, which is this little tiny island. It is the most remote, permanently inhabited island on Earth. It's about 2,500 kilometres away from St. Helena, Cape Town, and 3,000 kilometres from South America. There is no airport. The only way you can get there is by ship, and the shortest journey is a week. It was founded in the early 1800s by 15 original settlers, and then a very small number of people came later. And it turns out that there were more left-handed people there in the beginning, combined with the fact that they were, when rediscovered by, I forget who, I think it was the British, that they had a fairly violent society. And there is an advantage in fighting and being left-handed because your opponent thinks that the strike will come from the right hand. So it's a combination of those factors. So is that kind of answering your question, that would left-handed become the dominant trait? No, because you still have right-handed people being born. And I think over time it would drift back, but it has not done all the way that in Tristan da Cunha yet.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. That was a great answer. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Brent.
Thank you, Dr. Brent.
Hey, Corey, in your book you talk about the first tools that First Nations people use, particularly when it came to axes, stone knives, spears. Has there been any evidence that they did switch between their left and right hands at all when they were using these, or...?
I didn't find any evidence of that during my research, but the interesting thing about those tools was actually how Aboriginal people utilised glass. Now, the Gidja people up in the Kimberley region, they used to collect natural glass that was made from lightning strikes. So lightning strikes are huge energy, a lot of heat, and obviously sand turns into glass when you get a lightning strike. However, they shaped these arrowheads into glass arrowheads, and they were designed to break off inside the animal, and they hemorrhaged. So, you know, when we look at the tools and how Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people use tools, we know that, for example, Mungo Man was actually right-handed because his elbow had, he had tennis elbow from potentially throwing woomeras and spears. So we can say historically with some of the Indigenous people that have been found on this continent, which hand they were because of the hand that they, the arm, there'll be like, there'll be worn marks on skeletal remains.
Wow.
And things like that.
Oh my gosh. All right. Merv in Melbourne, you've got a question about something that's been in the news a lot recently. What do you want to know?
Yes. Hello, doctors. The M5 blue flu virus that's going through the birds at the moment. Where did it come from? Has it been here all the time and stuck in the permafrost and is just recently, because it's just suddenly turned up and been transmitted, or has it escaped from some mad scientist's lab like coronavirus, or has it been here in the shape of a normal flu that's just mutated and got worse and worse? And if that's the case, could it get even worse still?
Right. Now, Murphy, you said coronavirus escaped from a mad scientist's lab. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's, you know, come from China, they say. So that was just, yeah.
Okay, so we've, according to the scientists, which is not necessarily the same as certain parts of the press, coronavirus came from the wild. It didn't escape from a laboratory. But with regard to viruses and the flu virus, let me give you two extremes. Measles. You get a vaccine against measles twice and you are protected for the rest of your life. You can go into a society full of where everybody's got measles, but you've been vaccinated and almost certainly you will not come down against it because the measles virus does not mutate. Flu virus is at the other end of the spectrum. It mutates like crazy. Now, there's these two letters associated with flu, H and N. Heme, H stands for hemagglutinin, and there are 16 different types. And N stands for neuraminidase, and there are 9 types. So you can have H1, N1, H16, N5. You know, there's a whole bunch of variations. And the flu virus uses that as a way to get into our cells to take over from us. Getting back to H5N1, the first time we ever found the dangerous form was in geese in southern China in 1996, and in the following year, it jumped across to humans. And sometime around then, according to my mates in infectious diseases, the Chinese government came into Hong Kong and overnight killed every single chicken in Hong Kong. And as a result, it did not escape to humans, and we survived that particular one. Did it come from melting permafrost? Very unlikely. Could have escaped from a laboratory? Possible, but really unlikely. From what we're seeing in how it's been mutating and comparing this one to the previous ones, we know that we're guessing almost certainly that it came from the wild. And the thing is that the reason it spreads so good is it can affect many different species, like a lot of birds, so it can fly from one place to another. And then it can go into the animals on the land, like the foxes and the cats and the dogs, and sometimes the humans, and creatures in the ocean, like sea lions. So each time it goes into a new species, it mutates again. Mm. So what's going to happen to it here in Australia? It may mutate to get really nasty in humans and be able to jump to humans. Unlikely, but we hope that doesn't happen. And the other extreme is that it will mutate into something that doesn't spread from animal to animal. What will happen is somewhere in between, and if we're lucky, it probably will not turn into a pathogenic form. We're watching it really closely now. I've already been vaccinated last year, and I got a bit of the flu that left me, it knocked me down for a month, and it took me a month before I could catch 12 waves in a surf and play tennis for an hour. That was the first time in my life. So flu can really kill a lot of people.
Yeah. Corey?
Yeah. Nice to hear from you, Merv, as well. The H5N1 virus, which we've just had a confirmed case in Biripi country on Hawk's Nest. Most of these viruses, particularly the bird flus, as Carl referenced in 1996, they actually come from poultry farms. Because what happens is when we stress birds out, they release pathogens and they also release viruses and they mutate. Now, the biggest concern for this particular virus is it's spreading to marine mammals because this virus in particular has jumped from poultry to seabirds, and seabirds are the best spreaders of this virus because they're migratory birds. And the other concern there will be is that if this gets into mammals, you know, places like Lutuwia and Tasmania, unfortunately some of the mammals on that island and down there will be affected by this virus if it mutates into marine animals. So there is some anecdotal evidence that this virus is starting to mutate into a virus that can affect mammals, and that's going to be problematic.
Dr. Carl?
And just an example of viruses. So back in the 1930s, a virus mutated and started killing chickens, and it killed well over 99% of all the chickens on Earth. And the only way we could have chicken farms was by having a chicken farm here and another one 10 kilometres away, another one 20 kilometres away. And for a long time, chickens were really rare, and it was a very special thing to invite somebody around for a chicken dinner. And then, after about half a century, we came up with the virus. The situation today is that there are 100 different varieties of this nasty virus roaming the world trying to kill chickens, and there are about 80 different virus vaccines, and every single commercial chicken is vaccinated at birth. And every 2 weeks after, either through spray of water through the air or in a drinking water or through just breathing through the air. And the only reason that you can have a chicken schnitty, chicken soup, barbecued chicken, fried chicken, any sort of chicken is because every chicken is vaccinated. Isn't that weird?
Crazy. Merv, thanks for your question.
Thank you.
We've got Brennan. Now, Brennan, what do you want to know today?
Hello, you got me?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're live to air, Dr. Brennan.
Beautiful. Thank you for taking my call, guys. Probably this one's for Corey. Over the journey, I've heard about Aborigines in the past that have sort of backburnt or you know, burnt the forest to reduce the risk of forest fires and the intensity, I suppose. I'm just wondering if that's something that we should be exploring now with obviously the population in those areas and the threat of loss of life through bushfires currently, if it's something that we should be looking very closely at.
Yes, most definitely, and we already are doing that. So, for example, in Arnhem Land, they are still practicing cultural fire management practices and have done the whole time. They don't have catastrophic bushfires up there. We are also doing it in New South Wales with the Yuin people, with the Fire Six Alliance, now known as a Living Knowledge Practice Organisation. They are teaching cultural fire management practices. They're also bringing our cultural fire management practices to New Zealand and Canada. And, you know, when we look at traditional fire stick farming or cool burns, they have a set of rules that, you know, the whole methodology of cultural fire management practices is to keep the country young. So we burn in really small pockets in really low flames, and we don't burn treetop canopies. The reason for that is that if you burn the treetop canopy, the animals won't be able to escape the fire. It also wrecks the pattern. And the whole idea of practicing the cool burns and burning in particular seasons and times of year means that you keep the plants young because they regrow and they don't have as much fuel. So cultural fire management practices are being adopted widely across the continent. And we aren't seeing catastrophic bushfires where those cultural fire burns are happening.
So probably at least, next part of my question or point of my question. So my brother was up in the Blue Mountains when the bushfires went through there a decade ago, I suppose. And part of the, I suppose, the attraction of living in those areas is the bushland around. So once these cool burns or whatever you call them are done, is the regeneration quick enough for those areas, I suppose, to become or to stay, you know, beautiful, for want of a better term, where people actually still want to live there because of those conditions?
Yeah, and you've got to think about it from a First Nations point of view. Our seasons don't really marry up with European seasons. We might have 6 or 7 or 8 different seasons based on that traditional owner group. So the Darug people, and shout out to any Darug people out there and the Wiradjuri people who are the traditional owners of the Blue Mountains, there would be their own set of ecology-based rules for cultural burns for the Blue Mountains. But when we do cultural burns on country, we generally do it when it is cooler, where there is a lot of moisture. And the whole concept of that is doing it at the right time of year so that it can foster that regrowth. So there is a lot of dew, there is a lot of moisture, and then that means that the plants can recover quicker. And so like with the Blue Mountains and those devastating bushfires, the problem is that the landscape has been altered because those practices weren't practiced, and it takes a while for that ecosystem to go back to what we call a normal state.
Yes.
Thanks, Brennan.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Dr. Carl?
Yeah, well, two things. Firstly, when Charles Darwin, the evolution guy, came to Australia, he went ashore in Perth and he happened to find himself in a situation where some older Indigenous people were teaching the young kids about how to do the fire burning. And it took the best part of a day. And it wasn't as though, quickly put on your hazmat gear and get really dressed up. It was sort of really casual and relaxed, but they were teaching them really good things along the way. And it was just an amazing thing that they were learning. And so, secondly, that leaves the country better. So if you read the book, The Largest Estate, that will sort of take you through. It's a fairly hard book to read. It's very full of dot points. It's not easy to read, but the result of the burning, filled me out on this one, Corey, was that you end up with something that looked like it had been manicured by highly paid gardeners for decades.
Yes, and there is another book that is really important to read. It's called Fire Country by Uncle Victor Stepherson, and it talks all about cultural fire management practices. And he's a legend, Uncle Victor. He's a Kuku Yalanji man, and he is one of, you know, he's doing amazing work around Australia, teaching traditional owner groups how to care for their country again.
Thanks so much. Hey, Corey, going forward, just to clarify as well, when we are speaking about Aboriginal people, it's important to use that term, Aboriginal people, First Nations people, or the specific clan group?
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's really important, you know, when we talk about our mob, we don't use words like Aborigine because that can be really hurtful to a lot of different groups. So when I talk about a group, I'll use their traditional name.
Thanks so much.
And if you don't know it, don't, you know, just say Aboriginal, mob, you know, whatever. It's all good.
We've got Louise in Singleton here. Dr. Louise, you had a pretty, what you've described as magical experience at the Blue Lake, the Jenolan Caves. Take us there. What did you see? What was going on?
Oh, hello. I'm so excited to ask about this. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for talking to me. About 12 years ago, I visited Jenolan Caves, and it was quite an emotional time for me. But I went for a wander around the Blue Lake there, and I was just sitting on the grass, and I looked out, and there was a pair of platypus playing in the water, which I thought, oh, this is awesome. And then there were a pair of bearded, little young bearded dragons sort of jumping in and out of the water next to that. And then I sort of walked around a bit and there was a pair of lyrebirds, and I was gobsmacked that I even saw lyrebirds in the flesh. And I walked around a bit further and there were a pair of large skinks. And this was all within the space of maybe half an hour, an hour. And I was just, it felt like I was getting a message, or I'd never experienced anything like that before. The next day I had a chat with some of the guides and asked if there was anything like that about, you know, in old stories or something like that. I've done a few searches and asked a few people, and I just wondered if there was any stories like that that anybody else had come up with, or if there was some kind of precedence in like the Indigenous culture. Or
Louise, it sounds like Noah's Ark. Corey, can you speak to this at all?
It sounds wonderful, and loved Jenolan Caves too. But in terms of like Indigenous Australians and First Nations knowledge, animals do mean things when they appear. So for my family, we have the Bigabeela, which is the echidna, and that is our totem on Gamilaroi country. And that, when I see Bigabeela in the wild, often it correlates with someone that has died in the family. So I always think when I see a Bigabeela on a bushwalk, or I see one randomly, oh, someone's going to pass away. And I've only really started noticing it in the last, you know, probably 5 years. Every time I've seen a wild echidna, a member of my extended family has passed away. And I remember my pop telling me this a long time ago. He goes, if you ever see a Bigabeela in the wild, you know, and you see a Bigabeela just spontaneously, it generally means someone's passed away. And I became a zookeeper and I saw bigger bieler and echidnas all the time. So, you know, I kind of got unconditioned from seeing them. And then the other thing as well is that Professor Rob Bull from the University of Adelaide, the late, great Professor Rob Bull, did a study on shingleback lizards. We call them bogeye in Gimilaroi language. And bogeye are monogamous species. And sorry to any ladies out there, they give birth to the equivalent of a teenager. That's half, more than half their body.
Oh, my
gosh. They mate for life, but they also have a grief hormone that in their brain. So if a shingleback gets hit by a car, they will actually grieve their partner.
Wow.
Which is, you know, we don't think about that about reptiles, right? But we know that First Nations groups around the country who have bogeye talk about how they're monogamous and talk about how they breed for life. And they're a very, very special animal for those nations. Now, the really interesting thing about the shingleback is that they put a radio tracker on a bonded pair and they measured that the shinglebacks were separated by 400 kilometres and they found each other.
Wow.
Ultimate love story.
Oh, my God, they found each other.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Unfortunately, they get taken for the wildlife trade and they get hit by cars. And that breaks the pairs up. So we've got to look after shinglebacks.
Yeah. We've got Lucy in Magra, Tasmania. Now, Lucy, what's your question?
Hello, doctors. So my question to you is, so I work as a distiller in the alcohol manufacturing industry, and I hear this quite often that women apparently have better palates than men. Is this, I suppose, is there anything that actually backs this, or is this potentially because we grow up with pretty perfumes and moisturisers from a young age, whereas boys tend to come across smells and that sort of stuff when they're made to wear deodorant?
Very interesting perspective there, Lucy. You know, and you think about it, it's usually an Africa scent that they usually come across in their teen years. Dr. Carl, can you speak on this?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, on average, women do have a slightly more sensitive smell and a slightly better palate than men, but we're not exactly sure why. Is it a combination of biology or experience, one or the other, or both combined? So, but in the tests, when we do it, women can detect very faint odours. Can you smell that? Nah. A woman, yes. Can you pick this smell from that? Are they frying ham or prosciutto? Okay, they can pick that. And sometimes very subtle flavours. We have found, but this might not be related, that women apparently have around 40% more neurons, nerves, in the olfactory bulb, which is the part of the brain that processes smells. And also, hormones are involved. So a woman's sense of smell can, but not always, change during pregnancy and during different phases of the menstrual cycle and after menopause. But also, as you mentioned, there's the experience. There's the perfumes, the cosmetics. Am I going to wear this? Am I going to have that one? But it turns out that they build up a richer smell, a richer library of smells in the brain. And interestingly, women are better at naming smells than men. With tastes, we've only got the five basic tastes, but you can combine them. And we used to think that we could detect about 10,000 different tastes. Now it seems to be up in the millions and even trillions. Yeah, so nature and nurture working together, probably.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Donna in Blackheath, what's your question? We might be finishing on you here.
Oh, beautiful. Hey, doctors. Yeah, it's Donna here from Blackheath. Look, my quick question is, why do bowerbirds collect blue objects? Is it something to do with how they see the different colours on the rainbow spectrum?
Yes. So bowerbirds have avian supervision, which allows them to see in ultraviolet light. So if you're an aspiring criminal, stay away from bowerbirds. CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. That is the fourth cone cell that allows them to see in ultraviolet light. Now, the second part of your question is, why do they collect blue things? Well, it happens to do with the male bowerbird. He has to collect so many blue things because he wants to make his nest aesthetically pleasing. And his life as a father depends on his ability to make his nest as bright and as colourful as it can be. However, there is a bio-evolutionary trait where blue in the animal kingdom generally means I'm venomous and I'm dangerous. So a blue-tongued lizard, for example, has a blue tongue because it's the ultimate creature of bluff. And by having as many blue things around your nest, you can protect your eggs.
Wow. So it's not, you know, pretty aesthetics. It's actually a bit of a warning.
Yeah.
The male bird is also blue, like the objects they collect is blue. So it's interesting as well. Yeah.
Wow. No walkers.
Donna, yeah. Thank you so much for your question. And Corey, thank you so much for joining us. You work with Deadly Science. You are a snake wrangler at the moment. What are you working on at the moment? What's something we can keep track of to find out what you've been up to?
Well, Deadly Science has been going out to, we've gone out to 1,700 schools already. We're building traditional bush soap, teaching kids how to wash their hands, getting a bit of the bowerbird stuff, putting kids' hands under UV light and teaching them how to wash their hands properly, which is really important to prevent disease. We've been working with communities all over Australia to embed First Nations knowledges in the curriculum. And also in my private life, I've been a dad recently. He's nearly two, my son, and I've been catching snakes in my spare time.
We can follow all your adventures online as well. Where should we follow you on socials?
You can follow Corey Tutt on my Instagram page or Facebook page, whatever your poison. You can follow Deadly Science and keep up to date with all the cool things we're doing around Australia.
So sick. And your new book is out right now. It is called Before It Was Called Science, 65,000 Years of First Nations Knowledge. Corey Tutt, thank you so much for joining us this week for NAIDOC Week. Happy NAIDOC Week to you.
Happy Black Christmas, everyone.
So good. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you again next week.
Peachy keen.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. A big thank you again to Corey Tutt for joining us. We love having him on. And if you want to check out more about his work, Deadly Science, any of his books, we've popped a link to Deadly Science for you in the show notes wherever you're listening. This episode was produced by Matteo Bascarin. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.